Welcome to Blue Sky Banter, a conversation with legal luminaries about corporate governance, M&A, securities regulation, and more. It's Wednesday, April 4th, and I'm Wren Holding, the editor of Columbia Law School's Blue Sky blog. I'm speaking today with Robert Jackson, a commissioner of the Securities and Exchange Commission. He came to the commission from NYU Law School, where he was a professor. And he was, of course, for years a familiar face around here at Columbia as a professor and the director of the Program on Corporate Law and Policy. He has also served as an advisor at the Treasury Department and in the Office of the Special Master for TARP Executive Compensation. Welcome, Commissioner, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much, Rand. I'm delighted to be with you today.
I wanted to talk first about the experience of becoming an SEC commissioner. You've called, I think, the Senate Banking Committee hearing on your nomination the ultimate job interview. A lot of us have had big job interviews, of course, but how did you prepare for this one? What kind of help did you get?
Well, let me start by saying what an honor it was to be nominated for the job and to be considered by the Banking Committee. And it really did feel, Wren, like as I said in the speech a little while ago, the ultimate job interview. And what was sort of interesting about the experience is how many friends, former students, Columbia colleagues were so willing to help me get ready for it. And what we did was try to think through what issues would be on the senators' minds that are before the SEC and what they might need to know right. about the agency and its mission and its future. And I prepared with, again, a team of former colleagues, former students for a period of many months in mock sessions where we imagined what might be asked, and I tried to give the very best answers that I could. And I felt very fortunate to have help from so many friends, because what's hard about that job interview, and what's different from any other I've had before, is not only is it televised, but you feel very much like you are the subject of congressional inquiry.
Right.
And even that might not be the case, you want to be sure you put your best foot forward. And in my case, my parents were sitting right behind me. So
oh, really?
I wanted to make them proud, and yeah. I felt very, very lucky that the hearing went well.
So it wasn't the same advice, similar to what judicial nominees seem to get, keep it general. I mean, you really had to hone in on specific issues.
Yeah, you know, the SEC commissioner process has changed over the last 5 or 10 years. I think if you look back at, for example, and I spent some time studying the transcript of the confirmation hearing of my mentor and former Columbia colleague Harvey Goldschmidt,
right.
who was just a wonderful commissioner. When I looked at his hearing, it was much more general. You know, Harvey had an opportunity to talk about substance, but at a higher level.
Right.
You know, now, Wren, senators demand answers.
Yeah.
They expect to know what your priorities will be. And I wanted to be in a position where I could give those answers, but not pre-commit or prejudge any yeah. issue before I was confirmed.
And speaking of which, I think one senator placed a hold on your temporary hold on your nomination until you answered several specific questions from her. Did that worry you at all at the time?
Yes, it was Senator Tammy Baldwin, who I'd had the pleasure of meeting before she asked those questions. And she sent a letter to both me and Hester Pierce, my co-nominee and now my colleague here at the commission. And she asked about activist investing and some research that I'd done in that area, and
right.
stock buybacks and executive compensation, an issue that's near and dear to my heart. I thought it was a good example of what I was saying earlier, that senators really now do want to know what your priorities are going to be.
Right.
And we can debate whether that's a good or a bad thing. I know many people have and will continue to do so. But for my purposes, you know, at the end of the day, we have a constitutionally mandated process in which the Senate and the individual senators have a great deal of latitude in exploring a nominee's qualifications before they confirm you. And I generally think that's healthy, and I'm very happy to answer those questions and delighted, of course, to be confirmed just a few weeks later.
Sure. And what's your sense of what the committee as a whole was most concerned about?
So I think, the Banking Committee is made up of a very interesting group of senators coming from all different, obviously from both of the principal political parties, but also all different backgrounds and with different priorities. So, you know, let me just give an example. Senator Heitkamp asked a number of very important questions about the small business emphasis of the commission, recent legislation that she'd worked on to help the commission better meet the needs of small businesses, and wanted to know what my priorities would be in that area.
Right.
And you could go everywhere from that to Senator Warren, who wanted to know from both me and Commissioner Peirce about our views about completing Dodd-Frank.
Right. And
everything in between. One senator wanted, you know, to know in detail my views about cost-benefit analysis, about which I'd written while at Columbia. So as a whole, I think what the committee's trying to get at is not any particular policy issue. I think often people feel like they're trying to pin you down. I don't think that's what it is. I think they want to know that fundamentally you're an open-minded individual who will come, who will give the arguments they care about deep consideration.
Right.
And that's certainly the impression I tried to give, and I know Hester did too throughout the process.
Did anything surprise you? Were you asked anything that you hadn't prepared for or that you weren't expecting them to ask?
No, I think I was fortunate in that, you know, again, former students, colleagues, folks from the Obama administration who I'd worked with were really good about preparing me. I did have one interesting experience with a relatively new senator, Senator Kennedy from Louisiana, who who later made news in questions he asked a judicial nominee, who was not confirmed.
Right.
And he asked me whether or not I'd ever bought a stock. First of all, it's a perfectly fair question, of course. And being under oath and sitting in front of my mom and dad, I wanted to answer it truthfully, and the truthful answer is that I had. And then he asked me in some detail about whether I had read the prospectus.
Right.
And here I was a little embarrassed because, you know, Ren, as you and my colleagues at Columbia, especially Professor Coffey, know well, I am a true securities geek. And the answer is that I had read the prospectus.
Yeah, well,
so I gave him that answer.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it was what he was looking for. He was trying to make a broader point about prospectuses and are they useful to investors and such.
Right. Do investors read them? And, of course, for the vast majority, the answer is no, but you being
of course,
you being you, the answer was yes. And that brings me to my next topic, dual class shares. Companies that have two classes of shares with different voting rights, sometimes one class with no voting rights at all. And you've spoken about them. And as I understand it, your concern is with creating what you call corporate royalty, a class of shareholders who control a company permanently. But that maybe dual class shares make some sense for founders who are trying to get their companies up and running. And I'm wondering if there's also an argument that they also can make sense beyond that because they discourage so-called short-termism, running a business for the short-term gains. What do you think?
Oh, it's a good question, Ren. Yes, this was the subject of my very first speech. And as you point out, I made the argument there that although dual class may be useful early in a company's life cycle, and especially when a founder has what Zohar Goshen has called an idiosyncratic vision for the future of the firm,
right.
In those cases, for the early part of a firm's life cycle, dual class can be extremely valuable. And in fact, there is a recent paper by Martin Kremers and co-authors providing some empirical data to that effect. And in the speech, I offered some preliminary data in that respect as well. The argument I made in the speech was that that's not a justification for what I'm calling perpetual dual class stock,
right.
Or dual class stock that after a founder's death can be passed to his or her heirs, handing off control to the founder's children. I was skeptical that the ability to hand off control of a company to a founder's children is necessary in terms of maximizing firm value. And to your point, Ren, what I would say about long-termism is, you know, there's a lot of debate right now about how long-termism is and how short-termism is. Sometimes I hear that it's quarterly capitalism we should be concerned about. Sometimes I hear that 3 years is not sufficiently long-term. And we can put those questions to one side for now, and I think we should agree that however long long-term is, it's not forever, which is why I made the argument I did, which is that dual-class shares should be usable. I think the exchanges should make rules in this area that permit their use. But the idea that they should be used forever and after a founder's death, he or she should from the grave exercise control over corporate enterprise, that's one I think deserves closer scrutiny. And in fact, I think there's not a very strong case for that at all.
Right. So what's the answer? Sunset provisions?
Well, in the speech, I tried hard not to be prescriptive. I sort of suggested that I'd like to see the exchanges work on this and talk to the investing community and others about what they need. I think sunset provisions are a good idea, but I want to be clear that I would not in any way mandate that dual class go away at a particular time. Instead, what I would suggest the exchanges look at, and I hope that they will soon, is a provision that just requires a vote by the minority shareholders with respect to continuing the dual class structure. Because see, Ren, my view is if 10 or 15 years into a company's life, the founder has shown that his or her vision is compelling and generates value, they will be able to maintain control simply by asking the shareholders to continue it.
Right.
And again, I would say, certainly I share the concern about short-term horizons in the investment community today, but however long-term should be, I'm not sure we need to give people control forever
right.
to invest for the long term.
Right. Now, as you know, several stock indices have put strict limits or even banned companies from listing with dual-class shares. My question is, what's the downside of that? But I think I probably know your answer, but what is the downside of that? That there just
well,
should
I think
not
there
be
are...
one rule that fits all situations. Is that right?
Exactly. I think there are three downsides to that, Ren. First, when we get these companies left out of exchanges, keep in mind that ordinary retail middle-class investors overwhelmingly invest in our stock market through the exchanges,
right.
which means that the most exciting idiosyncratic vision, future-type companies, really compelling companies, the next Facebook, the next Uber, the next Google, those companies are going to be left out of the index, and those investors are going to miss out on that growth. And I would be very troubled that the American middle class is left out of the growth of our most exciting companies, first.
Mm-hmm.
Second, I worry about the particular steps the indices have taken, in some cases excluding dual-class companies altogether. So even a company that comes public, dual class, but says in 5 years we'll have a vote
right.
or we'll have a sunset, even those are excluded from some indices. And I worry about one size not fitting all, as you suggested. And then finally, and I think most importantly, the indices, of course, investors can and should bring their concerns about this to the various indices. And nobody forced the indices to make these changes. But governance by index, taking governance disputes to the indices raises a host of serious concerns for me. One thing is that the indices, when making these decisions, are not subject to meaningful disclosure or regulatory oversight. Many of them, because they're very thoughtful and the folks who run them are very smart, have done discussion papers or analysis or even had public comments and consultations on those questions. But I'm not sure that the indices are the place to do governance work in this country. I'm hoping that the index, the exchanges will return to their historical role in overseeing governance and step up in this area. And I'm optimistic. I hope that they will.
Yeah. And do these sorts of rules tend to push some companies to list abroad? Is that a real danger or is that overblown?
Well, I think the argument about competitiveness in the U.S. exchanges is a real one. And I don't want to give it short shrift. But the bottom line, Ren, is that today our exchanges aren't competing. I mean, they're very much competing internationally, but I think if you ask them, they would say their bigger concern is competing with our private markets. I mean, Ren, at the moment, raising money in our private markets is it's very frothy right now. People are getting very good valuations in that space. And I think a real concern that one could raise about limiting the options of public companies is the alternative will be to keep them private.
Right,
and that really leaves out many investors that I care about and that I'm now sworn to protect. And I think that's a very real concern. Here's what I'd say about dual class. I can't think of any company that wouldn't go public simply because the founder could not pass control of the company on to his heirs. I can imagine a number of companies that wouldn't go public if the founder couldn't control the firm during his lifetime, for example, or at least for the foreseeable future. But I'm willing to speculate that there's no company out there, not Uber, not the most exciting growth stories in our economy, that where the founder would say, I would love to go public, but only if my kids get to run the thing.
Right.
And that's why I call for the reform that I have.
Yeah. Okay. Another topic that you've also taken on and talked about is mandatory arbitration of shareholder complaints. And companies, I think, generally like it, of course, because it's ostensibly cheaper and more efficient than litigation, but also because it stops them from having to face what they believe and sometimes, understandably, are nuisance suits. What do you say to them?
Well, you're right. This is something I've dedicated a great deal of time and attention to. And I think what I'd say to companies who are worried about frivolous litigation and who think that we should do something about it, first of all, we've taken very significant steps in that respect. So we have the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, which very substantially increased the proof thresholds in this area.
Right.
The Delaware courts, which have a great deal of expertise that we at the federal level can't possibly replicate, have taken significant steps with regard to settlements of shareholder suits just in the last 12 months.
Right.
And what I would say is, to the degree that a company or an outsider thinks that's not enough, we at the SEC should consider their arguments. But my view is that we should consider them in a thoughtful, fulsome process. It should be a typical standard public rulemaking process in which the public gets a chance to make the arguments on both sides. On the one hand, that shareholder litigation is expensive and inefficient, and on the other hand, that shareholder litigation is really the only way we hold corporations accountable today. And the SEC can review these arguments and make a decision. What concerns me, Ren, is this notion that a company might slip this kind of provision into a charter and that we at the SEC might, on a company-by-company basis, overwhelmingly change the law of enforcement of fiduciary duties in this country just in a one-company charter. That's not, to me, the way to make good policy.
Right. And I think at least one of your colleagues has essentially invited companies to put arbitration provisions in their IPOs and to really sort of test the SEC's views. I take it you don't necessarily agree with that approach.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think one of my colleagues has said that, and I would say with all respect that this is not the way we should make securities law in this country. And that colleague and many others on both sides of the aisle have repeatedly suggested that the way to do good policymaking in this space is detailed cost-benefit analysis, where we consider the various arguments, and we have our Division of Economic Risk Analysis do detailed studies. We invite the state courts who are working on these issues and who see this litigation to comment on them, to give us information about what the effect of our change might be. And so I have to tell you, I'm a little puzzled that my colleagues are focused on the prospect of slipping this in through a charter provision or
right.
somehow doing this in anything other than an open process. It's just not the way I think we should make securities law in the United States.
Right. And finally, I don't want to let you go without asking you about digital coin offerings. This is a very prominent area now, of course, and a pretty murky area. And I know it depends, but is it generally clear that securities are involved and that the SEC has jurisdiction to regulate these things? What do you think?
Well, it's a very important question, Ren, because you know every week we hear stories of millions of dollars being raised in the ICO space, and you know I had the pleasure of being on a panel at Columbia last week with former Commissioner Dan Gallagher.
Right.
And we were asked about this, and Dan said, and I agree, and he really echoed what the chairman has been saying, which is, you know, neither of us, none of the three of us, has yet seen an offering of this type that is not a security.
Right.
You know, one of the great things about securities law is that we have long-standing principles that help us understand what a security is. And although technology is changing every day, those principles are still useful. And when we apply them in this space, I think it's very clear that the overwhelming majority of things that we're seeing meet the standard test to be a security. And that's particularly true when the offering in question is related to the building of an infrastructure that right. doesn't yet exist.
Right.
I'm not against people raising money so that they can build a service or infrastructure. In fact, that's at the heart of the American economy. But we have a name for it, Bren. We call that a security.
Right.
And I would think that I'm very hopeful that people in that space are getting the chairman's message loud and clear. I get the sense that they have. And I think his leadership here has been very important because he's made clear to the market that securities lawyers need to give sometimes hard advice, but the right advice so that investors are protected.
Right. And is the main regulatory thrust, the proper regulatory thrust here, enforcement? In other words, to review these things and when they look bad, to take action?
Well, that's right. And I think our enforcement staff have just done extraordinary work in this area. And that's especially true of our colleagues in the San Francisco Regional Office, who I've met with more than once on the subject and have consistently impressed me with their access to the space, their understanding of what's happening in the marketplace, and the way that they've gone about making clear that fraudsters are going to hear from us. And I think, you know, Chairman Clayton's leadership has been important, but at the end of the day, where the rubber meets the road at the SEC is in our staff.
Right.
When they make clear in a market like Silicon Valley that if you do this kind of raising and you do it in a way that doesn't comply with the law, you're going to hear from us. And I'm really, really proud of the work we've done in that space.
And in your view and in their mind, the law is clear. These are securities. These are the rules. They've been around for many, many years. Comply with them.
Well, again, I don't want to prejudge more generally, both for sort of procedural reasons and also because, as you know, Ren, it's a facts and circumstances kind of test.
Right.
And who knows what will come before us in the future. But I will say, again, I've seen a lot of these things. A lot of these things have come across my desk, and I agree with Commissioner Gallagher and Chair Clayton. I haven't seen one yet that isn't a security.
Right.
And I know that the bar is thinking through those issues and working hard to figure out, are there cases where these shouldn't be thought of as securities? And if so, what will the cases look like? And I think, I hope, in the next 12 to 18 months, we'll begin to have a conversation not only about stopping fraud in the ICO space, but also making sure that legitimate offerings can go forward in the, you know, using the sure. standard investor protections we've always used.
Yeah. Well, interesting stuff. We're going to have to leave it there. Commissioner, I want to thank you again for being with us.
And it's my pleasure, Ren. Thanks again for having me.
My pleasure as well. And listeners, join us again soon for another edition of Blue Sky Banter.